For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. I'm lucky enough today to have as my special guest Professor Joseph Ibrahim, the head of the Health, Law and Ageing Research Unit at Monash University. Joe's advocacy for aged care reform is long-standing and includes giving evidence to the Royal Commission on Aged Care Quality and Safety, which delivered its final report to the government last week. Joe joined me from his desk at Monash University for a conversation which ranged from altruism to zeitgeist and back again. Joe, you've been a geriatrician for 30-odd years. Presumably, you got into it because you quite like older people and are fascinated by the things they need. Do you understand why we as a society are so bad at looking at old age and getting the aged care system right?
Well, Kate, I think that I've been a doctor for 35 years, been a geriatrician or in aged care for 30 years, and off a back of an envelope, I have seen over 15,000 patients that are over 65 and their families over that time. And the thing that I find, and the reason aged care is both fascinating because it's complex, but it's also very human about what people do. Yeah. Almost universally, older people have sacrificed themselves for the rest of society. And so they have generally been loath to make any noise or to argue for what they deserve. So I think the first thing is that older people don't complain. And when they complain, they don't complain very much. And most people dismiss their complaints as unimportant because they're old, and so because they're no longer working, that means their opinion doesn't have merit. And so those views mean that it's very hard to push for change. The other thing that I've seen is there's a real fear, and across the board, both in politics and everywhere you look, people don't want to get old, they don't want to be disabled, and they don't want to die. And when you talk about those three topics, people clam up or want to move on to something that's nicer, something they can empathise or visualise with. All of those areas are underdone and poorly treated. And so that disabled people really have had an incredibly raw deal for a huge length of time. People shy away from discussing the hard topics. And I found this when I cross over to do the research work and we look at elder abuse, sexual violence, suicide, homicide, people turn off from those conversations because they consider those unpalatable subjects. I thought that here is the bleeding obvious of something going wrong and I don't need to convince you to do something right. What I've discovered is that the horror of those things turns people off and you can't get them engaged to address it. I think you see that particularly with sexual violence. People either minimise or ignore that exists because they don't want to believe it exists. What we have is that the people in positions of authority who have the responsibility to take on these awful things are not taking on the responsibility that fits with their position. So I do this work not because I sit back and relax or I enjoy it or it makes me feel good at night. I do this work because it's awful, it's uncomfortable. I don't like doing it. I don't like talking about it. I do it because it has to be done. Someone has to do it. It's the right thing to do. The other thing I'm embarrassed to say is the 20 to 30-year-olds who I work with as research assistants or students, they're far braver and far more forthright about social justice and doing the right thing. Yeah. They're the people that want to tackle this head on, and I see my job as helping them to do that, even though I'm uncomfortable doing it and would be much happier looking at, I guess, more esoteric topics than things that are about poor behaviour of people hurting each other.
That must give you some hope, seeing those young people coming through.
I think the generation's coming through, and I think I too joke about the millennials and the and their approach to life, but their strength and their motivation to make the world better, I think, is far greater than my generation and the generation that followed. And I think that they will change things. What I struggle with is I don't understand why I have to make a case to reduce sexual violence, or why I have to make a case not to sedate a person with dementia, or why we have to make a case that personal care workers need more help and time to do their job properly, and we shouldn't be criticising them for doing the best they can with the resources that they have. I don't understand why those things have to be answered, because they're pretty in your face. And I think this is interesting in the papers that I've written for general media consumption, and when you get either feedback and comments, the really sad thing is that people will write in and say that they have their exit strategy and they're never going to go to aged care. They're going to choose to end their life beforehand. And if you sit and reflect on that, it's a bit like that joke about public speaking and death, that most people would rather be in the casket than giving the eulogy. Most people would prefer to be dead than to do anything to make residential aged care better. And you say, well, that's how illogical can you be?
Yeah,
you can express your fear that I hope that when I'm older, I'm able to maintain a quality of life and my independence. That's really what I'd like. And you say, I'm nervous should I need to depend on someone, and I'm nervous if I get dementia that I'm not going to be looked after properly.
Mm-hmm.
And the solution to that is, how can we make a system that actually provides the care that I would be happy to receive if I did develop dementia, if I did need to depend on someone? Why can't I do something to address that? Even if you know the system, even if you have money, you can't quite get what you want. And this is where I find people confuse the doing or the task that they want with the emotion, perhaps. Or what you want is for your mum to be happy and to have some joy in her day. What people focus on is when will we get her dressed, when will we get her showered, and once we've done the tasks, then our job is done, instead of thinking about what makes today worth living for this person. And we're not good at doing that. We jump to conclusions about what the day is worth. We colour it based on our own point of view instead of trying to empathise with the person. And we have de-skilled, and aged care from the government's point of view is highly reductionist. And so the funding model, everything's been reduced to person needs to be dressed, they need to be toileted, they need to be fed, and they need to be given tablets. Let's cost these out and we're done. Nowhere in those things is there what makes life worth living for this person, and understanding that what makes life worth living often is not very expensive and may not be expensive at all or cost anything. It's really then about a question about connection, giving the person a sense of purpose and contribution. And if we spent more time on that, a whole lot of other things would be, I think, a lot easier, and we would then restore our understanding of what it means to be a person or to be alive, and that everyone and everything really has value. You just might not be in, not according to my scale, but the one scale that we all have is we want every day that we live to be worth something to us and to someone else. And that something doesn't need to be very big, and that something might be, a kind word to a child or a person that's lonely, or mm-hmm. to reassure a friend, or to answer a question of a stranger, and to say, I've done something that's helped someone, however small, it felt to me it was significant to them mm-hmm. because they were, in a sense, lost till we stepped in. So the magnitude of those, what people call small things, they might be small for you to do, but they're often substantially greater to the recipient, the person who's there needing that. And, you know, in terms of as a doctor, as a teacher, people will come to me 10 years down the track and say, what you told me that day, I've remembered, and I can't mm-hmm. remember what I told them, because to me it was it was what was needed at that moment.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
because of either my experience or my insights or my naivety, having made those mistakes before,
mm-hmm.
I'm able to offer something that makes a difference to someone, and I didn't have to work hard for that piece of advice or that insight, but it helped someone else. So it sticks with them because it, you know, the magnitude of that gift, if you want to call it that, far greater than what it costs you. And I think that we've lost that. We don't understand the relative value of things for the other person, and we see them only through our eyes, which is an absence of empathy. That's one of the hardest things to generate, is empathy for older people, because we haven't been old. We don't want to empathise because we don't wish to be old, and we don't know how to empathise because we have not been old. When you meet someone with dementia, you struggle sometimes. You struggle, you don't know what to do, and you end up feeling guilty or you feel poorly, and so you stop trying, when what you need to be doing is not seeing the dementia, not seeing the disability, but saying, here is a person that is not smiling. I wonder what it would take to make them smile.
Is it practically possible to make an aged care system that does those things?
The short answer is yes, because that's just people. It's not like you need, you don't need a special fancy machine, or, you know, you don't need a positronic brain to do that. That's really about having people understand that people are people, and a kind word goes a long way. When we don't know what's happening around us, we get frightened. And when we don't have control, we get frightened and scared. When we rely on someone for something essential to us, we are scared because we don't know whether that person is going to help us or not. It's in providing that safety about, you know, I will always help you with this, even if I'm grumpy, I will still help you with this. It's providing that certainty that I'm not going to be left by myself to struggle, or you're not going to punish me because I can't do something, and because if I'm not continent, you're going to punish me to teach me a lesson. That's not going to work. Asking me what I'm afraid of and how I can fix that doesn't take a lot. What it does take is a little bit of time and a little bit of self-awareness. And what we've done is we've eliminated that by being task-focused, by billing, by task. If you're not doing something, then you don't get any money. And the personal care workers and nurses will tell you, the way they tell us, they say, well, there's too much paperwork. What people then do is say, well, let's solve the problem of paperwork. The nurses and the personal care workers aren't complaining about the paperwork. What they're really saying is, I don't have time to do the things that are important to the person that I can, and I know they want. And when I'm able to do that, I feel better about my job. They feel better. The only thing that you ever check on me is whether I have or haven't filled in these forms. And these forms really stop me doing the job that everyone really wants me to do. And how that then gets articulated is, too much paperwork, let's get rid of the paperwork, let's streamline the paperwork, let's And then you say, well, if there's no paperwork, I don't have a trail of evidence that you've done anything. I'm not going to pay you because it's not documented. And you haven't done any work. And if people can't see you, they assume you're not working. If you haven't written something, then you're not working. And you have nothing to show for it, because what we are looking for is, where is the piece of paper that says you were busy? You must have been doing nothing. It must be frightening for personal care workers to spend their whole day making someone feel that their life is worth living and bringing joy to that person's life. And at the end of the shift, they have nothing to show for it, and they know they're going to be criticised because they didn't do their job. That's what happens when you've got an entirely reductionist approach to what is a human service.
I'm chatting today with Professor Joe Ibrahim from Monash University. If you're enjoying this podcast, or even if you're not, we'd love to get your feedback. You can email me with your thoughts to cswannell, that's C-S for Sam, W-A-N-N-E-L-L, all one word, at mja.com.au. Catch up with our back catalogue at mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your pods. Back to our chat. Joe, you gave your evidence to the Royal Commission into Aged Care in August of 2020, I think, before the majority of COVID deaths had occurred in aged care facilities. You were critical in your evidence to the Commission. In your evidence, you talked about raising the alarm back in March and April about what was happening in aged care facilities around COVID. Obviously, the worst went on to happen, so your criticism was very much justified. Has anything improved since then?
Given that the community transmission, so one of the things, I guess, in Australia being really fortunate is the community transmission has been so low that there haven't been any significant outbreaks in aged care homes. So, you know, it's a bit like nothing's happened, so everything's working, or nothing's working, but because nothing's happened, we can't really tell. What was disappointing was that the federal department said they were putting out the seventh edition of their pandemic plan for aged care, but you can't locate the first six editions because they don't exist. Essentially rebadged the CDNA guidelines from the start and counted every revision as a new edition. That really raised there was no pushback or concern. The inquiries on Epping Garden and St Basil's were released, I think, literally on Christmas Eve. They got very little coverage, and again, the government pushed these as being independent reports, and they're clearly not independent reports. You know, that these were commissioned by the government. The terms of reference were quite narrow. They didn't really look at anything beyond the provider's role. And the two people conducting the review also sit on the advisory group for the Commonwealth. That they would have done, you know, whatever they could as professionally as they could. But they've stated that they didn't have access to all the people that they wanted to interview. There was nothing in the inquiry that would protect you as a whistleblower if you wanted to say anything. And they didn't have the authority to get people to give evidence. So from all of those points of view, to me, it doesn't stand up as an independent inquiry. Repeating that it's independent means that everyone believes it's independent because the word's there. Yeah, it's independent of what? Do people understand what an independent inquiry truly is? And the most independent inquiry we can have, in a sense, is a Royal Commission or an ICAC investigation, where the person has authority, no fear of retribution, and no concern about undue influence from any quarter of any part of society. That then is truly independent. I fear that people have forgotten the meaning of the word independent.
Last century, we changed the sector from healthcare to accommodation, and we handed it over to the private providers. Isn't that where the trouble really started?
Oh, absolutely. The trouble starts with John Howard and the 1997 Act, which makes aged care really corporatises aged care and says the free market will take care of it. And the very first thing is the reduction and accountability. So the reduction of the money allocated to and spent on nursing care. And so the game that gets played these days is people will play both sides of the coin. And we saw this in the pandemic. The residence is your home. It's not a hospital, is what people were saying for a long time. Come the pandemic, suddenly the nursing home is a hospital and it's not equipped or attuned or capable of delivering that. And so depending on circumstances, people will choose the mutually exclusive argument. It's your home or it's a healthcare facility. The reality to the simplest is it's actually is both. You can't call it one or the other. It's not designed to be one or the other. It needs to be designed to cater for both. So the charging accommodation bonds for scenic views and extra windows allows people to say, well, this is your accommodation bond because this is a really nice place with a beautiful grand entrance and so on and so forth. It's your home. And others then saying, well, it's mostly got a function as a hospital and we don't want to be sending people who get sick in a nursing home to hospital because they're using a lot of the emergency department's time and they're taking up hospital beds. And so we want diversionary strategies. And so the provider is sort of stuck in the middle. And you also have the federal-state divide, is that the state's funding the hospitals and the feds are funding the nursing home. And so you have, again, these thoughts around cost shifting. And you have gaps in communication, which, again, COVID highlighted. And we're well known that we know we've got a state-federal divide. We know that we've got different GP hospital divide. And we know we've got aged care facility hospital divide about how they operate. These are pre-existing stressful relationships that need far better coordination and understanding. And that was one of the reasons in the Royal Commission evidence was these were known. These are not surprises. So when you get all of these groups together in one place, you're going to get a huge disruptions in any goal-orientated activity or anything that you're trying to achieve won't be achieved because who's in charge of what element and what is our overall goal? And that hasn't been sorted out. It still hasn't been sorted out.
Do you think there is a real willingness within the government to act on the Commission's recommendations?
I think the government could rewrite the Act and not change very much. Because the question here, and I think governments of all colour and party and internationally what we've seen is governments give lip service and say they've done something and they've made small changes. You could tick the box and say, we've considered human rights with the new Act and we've strengthened the wording around the residence charter. What the new Act actually needs to do is remove the corporatisation or the commercial aspects of the Act that presume that a free market has sufficient applicability to work as a safety valve, that your ability to choose means that that contains and controls the market. I think that the panel guidelines, so there are guidelines how to set up a framework which are important in terms of the Act. If the government does follow through on the principle and the actual philosophy behind a human rights strengthened Act, it would then requires changes in both how the Act exists, how the providers behave, the education and training for staff, and having enforceable and visibly enforceable mechanisms for residents whose rights are abused or neglected. That requires a substantive overhaul. And it also requires recognition that an 83-year-old woman with multiple diseases, with dementia, who is a resident, chose to go to a home after having a catastrophic life event, such as a stroke or a fractured hip, from hospital. is not actually an activated consumer who's able to evaluate homes and choose the one most suitable for her. So the whole thing about free market is a nonsense from the very beginning. The other thing that makes the free market completely, I think it's actually an abuse, and it's very surreptitious or cynical, I think. I think using the term a free market exists is incredibly cynical, because there is no ability to get information about the care homes that have any real meaning for the resident. And there's been, you know, two amendments have both been put up that have been knocked back each time by Parliament. And it's not just been party specific. It's really about, can the home tell me how many staff are employed here? And we will not, as a country, we do not provide that basic information about how many people have staff the home that I'm going to. And then we say, you have free choice and the freedom to decide. The only thing that you really know about a home is what the residential bond is and what it looks like when you go in. That's about all the information you get. And that is nowhere near enough to choose a home or to call people to account. The other issue with the free market is that if you don't like something, you can legitimately complain and have action taken. You can leave. On both of those points, we fail as a nation. We fail that the complaints mechanism is essentially in-house and requires you to conciliate between yourself and the provider. Don't like that, you can go to the regulator, which will then ask you again to conciliate. Complaints then take forever to get anywhere. What you actually need is a mechanism that's outside that. I think there should be a legal aid company attached to each home where residents can go to, ideally, a human rights lawyer to have their complaint considered and represented by someone who has a strong understanding of human rights advocacy and is not part of the system, so they don't actually have a muddied motivation. The ability to complain in a free market in aged care doesn't really exist. And the other point about, if I don't like the service, I can leave and I don't have to come back. So if I go to a hotel and I don't like it, or if I go to a restaurant and I don't like it, or if I buy goods from a supermarket or a retail agent, I don't go back. I'm a resident that's 83, and this is the only place close to my family, and it takes me 2 hours to get dressed, and I already don't have any information to choose a better place. I don't like where I am, but where can I go? So I can't move freely. None of the free market mechanisms work for the resident. None of it works for the person that's supposed to be at the centre. So in redrafting the Act, the government would have to address those factors into the Act, and I don't know that they would have the courage to do that, because it's the right thing to do. There'll be enormous pushback on it, and the question then is, who's advising government? How do they choose their advisors? Who do they listen to most? Again, we don't have transparency on that. And again, if you use COVID as an example, there is an industry representative on the COVID committee or advisory group. It's completely unclear that there was no information available as to how they chose that provider or that person to be on the advisory group. There are roughly 3,000 homes in Australia. There are about 800 to 900 providers. And the government selects a provider, and the provider is Regis, just to sit on this advisory group. And so my questions would be to the government is, how did you choose, what was the process you went through to choose an industry representative? And the second question is, why Regis? Out of the 800 possible providers, why Regis? And then the third question is, do you believe Regis represents and has knowledge of the entire sector and how they operate, how the small privates operate, how the not-for-profits operate, how the charitable not-for-profits operate, and how the public sector operate? That issue then of transparency is who is advising on aged care policy? Yep. What is their background? What are their links to the industry? What are their links to government? Why should we believe that group? Is it diverse enough to provide us with information that represents what needs to happen in Australia or not?
Yeah.
And so in terms of levels of transparency, I think we've got to at least start there, because it's the people in influence, the people in decision-making roles that influence how things happen. The other thing I'm hoping, but it wasn't really to the fore in the council assisting's recommendations, was strengthening the representation of residents. The system exists for the benefit of the resident. It's hard to believe, but it's the resident. It's what they're supposed to be geared for. It's not meant to be geared for the staff who really aren't that well looked after. And
no,
it's not intended for the providers to make a profit. And so often what we see as the client of the aged care system is the provider being the client rather than the person most affected and who it's designed for is the resident. And again, there's over 200,000 residents. I had hoped and had argued to have community representation of the residents with roughly 3,000 homes. You can establish and support resident councils in each home, in each catchment area, and have each catchment area supported by, again, I'd be going with a human rights advocate who can then feed in up to a national level so that the views of the 200,000 residents and their families are always part of what we're doing and how things are operating. That would not cost a lot of money, eminently doable. If you were to set up, you know, a small pyramid structure to have state-based representation, catchment representation, you could get those collective views, and that would inform what was happening all the time, and we'd actually have information from the people who we were designing the service for.
If you were king of the world, Joe, would you just start again with this aged care system?
There's a fallacy from starting from scratch. And I think that the thing that might mean something to your listeners is that adage about this house has bad karma, I will leave it. This job is bad, I will leave it. My life will improve if I have a fresh start. Almost universally, the only thing you take with you is yourself. You can't solve your problems by shifting settings or shifting the people around you. That might help you partway, but the essence of most of our problems are inherent to ourselves and how we manage them. Starting again does not change people. So we could go for a fresh start, but the fundamental thing is we actually know pretty much what's wrong with the human side of care. You have enough people that know and want to do a good job. We have structures and we've got the knowledge both in aged care and in health in particular around quality and safety, how to work together, how to generate teams. We've got the science around measurement, both quantitative, qualitative. We have all of those things already and we're using them either not at all, suboptimally, or not paying sufficient attention to them. You know, the start again for me is rewrite the Act so it shows respect, honours that respect for the resident, and so you have a clear pathway for the resident to readily access any complaint or concerns that has meaning, and show respect for the staff. And if we have a system that shows respect for the residents, that shows respect for the staff, pays the staff what they're actually worth, then there's really no problem. Everything else gets fixed because we know how to fix everything else. What we sadly don't know, well in Australia, and I think in a lot of developed OECD countries, is you don't actually know how to look after each other. That's the fundamental failing, and it's then about how do you do that. And again, I come back to government, and both federal and state government, and they're the country's leaders. And how do they behave, and do they set a good example? Do they demonstrate equality and respect for all people? Mm-hmm. Do they debate and present themselves in a way that makes us proud and want to model on them? Do we have equal rights for women, people with disability, First Nations? What are we doing to deal with what are egregious injustices? If we're not addressing them, then it's very hard to then say, well, everyone should respect each other, because we've got no, we don't have that role modelling at government level, which then influences how the departments behave, and then influences how the groups or organisations they regulate. There are obviously large pockets of excellence around advocacy and respect for people, but as a society, you don't want to keep choosing each vulnerable group or population, saying, well, now it's the turn of the homeless for us to be nice to, and now it's the turn of another group. It really should be the nature of our society is that here are some fundamentals about people.
Yep.
Most people are good. Some people need help to stay on track, and let's work to make sure that everyone has a life resembling something that they want it to be. A lot of the change that I see, and one of the reasons it's been difficult, is it requires a certain degree of altruism. Actions that you take and the things that you do today will not be of direct benefit to you, apart from, in a sense, being virtuous or of value to you. You have to be willing to do something that benefits someone else but has no benefit to you and may in fact actually have a cost to you. And I see that very much in healthcare. The work that a GP has to do has huge benefit for the hospital that the hospital never sees, because the GP has seen patients and done work that doesn't require a person to go to a hospital. You don't see the benefit of that as the GP. And if you work in a hospital, the work a small hospital does that helps a larger one doesn't see benefit for the smaller hospital. Or within hospital departments, the work that you do in your department that helps someone else, you bear the labour costs to do something and the benefits felt down the track, and then you're penalised because you've not met targets. But overall, the organisation does meet its targets and functions better because you've done something that helps someone else. And I think that the sort of the reductionist philosophy is the counting every task that is done reduces the ability to be altruistic, even if it's part of your nature. That mechanistic approach doesn't work in human services.
Joe, thanks so much for your time today. We can but hope that the Commission's recommendations will generate some real and positive change. Thanks so much.
Good to talk to you, thanks.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.